Hello, everybody from the nation's capital. My name is Damian Galvin, bringing you an episode of the Politatine podcast, joined by my wonderful co-host, Max Kalman.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back again.
Yes, sir. And this is part two of a series that we're doing on union activity. If you guys haven't listened to part one, it was released about a week ago, so be sure to go and check that out. Part one focused on the historical context that surrounds union activity previously inside of the United States. This episode is going to focus on a recent victory and some ongoing strikes and essentially what is this whole labor movement that's currently, or it currently feels like is on the brink of taking place, if not already going to be like historically in 10, 20 years, you know, we're going to look back and be like, this is when the labor movement started.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've been seeing a huge surge in union activity, and general labor awareness of the fact that, you know, a lot of workers are getting screwed over by their employers, by their companies. And we're seeing a lot of workers start to unionize more, start to be more involved in the union, which is the most important thing. And very recently, we've seen a string of very influential and very important strikes that have happened.
Yeah. And just to back that up a little bit, data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that in 2021, there was a 53% increase in petitions to establish unions. This goes back into something that I think we were able to touch last episode when we were kind of dissecting the reason that union membership is on a decline. But one of those reasons, as we stated, was the fact that every time that a business is established, you have to petition to union or to unionize. And obviously, as more businesses are established, which is expected to happen, there's going to be less and less of a pool of employees that are considered union members. But, you know, the data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics is showing that despite that, we are seeing more and more petitions to establish unions. We also, you know, back around the same time had the activity surrounding Starbucks and other major corporations unionizing, including Amazon in Alabama. And we saw some efforts in New York. But the highlight of it, I think, was maybe 150 days ago now, 147 days ago, when the WGA declared their strike. I think that that really turned a page on what exactly union activity was going to look like for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, exactly. And the entertainment industry and media industry more broadly is one of the most congregated industries. They have a small number of very large corporations who own a significant amount of the entertainment you watch, corporations like Disney and
Fox Entertainment.
Yeah, Fox Entertainment, which is owned by News Corp, which owns everything, basically.
Yeah.
And a lot of the workers from these corporations started getting fed up, largely because of pay cuts, overworked in terms of hours. And also, they're starting to see the trend of a lot of these corporations who are now looking to AI to replace a lot of the laborers. And that was one of the main points in this strike. And we're going to get into a little bit later some of the wins that they achieved.
Yeah.
But one of the main ones was that they were able to prevent the a lot of the coalition of media corporations that they were fighting against from essentially replacing all their writers by bulk with AI.
Yeah, and something that's interesting and kind of parallels the writer strike, obviously, is the SAG-AFTRA strike, the acting strike that is happening as we're currently experiencing it. And something that's equally interesting when it comes to that is the fact that these corporations were looking to essentially make AI actors, right? They were taking digital face scans of individuals, of extras, of famous actors. And we saw famous franchises like Star Wars actually utilize this technology to like make shows. They were making full-on shows without actors' permission, because technically, well, I guess they technically did have their permission, but obviously that's a whole issue that they're striking against, the fact that they're able to do things like this. So thankfully, that is a win that they achieved, at least for now in the foreseeable future. And another thing that I think often got overlooked when it came to what was going on surrounding the WGA was the fact that these writers weren't being paid because of the transition to streaming services. Yeah, it was a big issue, because now you have services like Max or HBO or HBO Max, whatever they're calling it, and Netflix and Amazon Prime. And what would happen is these writers were essentially paid for the time that. So this was interesting. I watched a whole dissection of essentially what was happening in the industry. But what you would do is you would have writers. Previously, the idea was that a writer would come in, and as the show was being produced, these writers would stay on set and they'd watch their vision come to life, because writing isn't just creating the script, right? It's also creating the set, creating the scenes, the visuals, what exactly is going to be going on, who's going to be standing where. That's all elements that people often overlook when it comes to writing a show.
Yeah, and it's a huge proportion of the general production of a show is all involved in these writers, which is why, just because of the writer strike alone, even before the actors also got involved, it entirely halted all of Hollywood and the entire entertainment industry.
So what they were actually starting to do was 2 weeks, right, before the production would start, they would just fire all the writers so that they didn't have to pay them for the whole for the whole time of the production. So they would fire them, and shows were suffering because of it. The show production wasn't as good, show quality decreased, and now, thankfully, that's going to be a win. They're actually going to be able to stay on set on the shows that they're working on, but beyond that, they're also going to receive what are residuals, referred to in the industry as residuals, which essentially work like royalties. So they have a 2.5% increase in their residuals. So now when these shows are going on these streaming services, they're still being paid for it, which is the way that it should work, because you're producing a piece of content that's being consumed for however long afterwards. You should still be making the profits that these corporations are benefiting from, you know, from you having contributed to.
Yeah, exactly. And the big loophole that they used as well is that in all the writers' contracts before streaming became a major part of this industry, none of them touched on streaming as a thing, obviously, because it didn't exist yet. And so with the advent of streaming and them putting a lot of these new productions on various streaming services, they sort of use this as an excuse to be able to cut the amount of money that they're making from streaming, which was an ever increasingly popular way that people consume the entertainment that they watch.
Yes.
And they were able to use that as an excuse to cut the amount of money they were making from the same amount of work that they put in.
No, yeah, 100%. And it's something that's massive, but let's dive into, you know, because we're going to probably spend the rest of the episode complaining about the action that is to be done. So let's look at exactly what was achieved through, you know, class solidarity, essentially, as it is, and these workers coming together to fight for what they believed was some guarantees that they deserved. So beyond the increased pay and the residuals that we were talking about, we also have better protections for writers on streaming services, a new formula that was created referring back to the residuals. So now it's going to be calculated differently, and they're going to be paid an exponential amount depending on how much these shows are being streamed. Because, like, think about shows like Friends, right? Friends was what, written 20 plus years ago, 25,
yeah, maybe? In the 90s.
Yeah, in the 90s. And Friends, what, regained popularity, let's say, half a decade ago? Like, people still, I think, watch Friends. Well, before it got sent to Piedmont or whatever. But when it was on Netflix, I know everyone.
Yeah, when it was on Netflix, Friends, it was popping off.
And that's the thing, right? Like, these writers and even the actors aren't making any more money from it because their contracts have expired. But the streaming services and the executives are still benefiting because of the fact that it's on these streaming services. Mm-hmm. So this new formula benefits them. It's also, you know, as you were mentioning, there's going to be those protections from AI replacing them. And there's going to be a resolution process for these writers when they have issues with the streaming services. So all in all, more democracy in the workplace is always a good thing. And it seems like these union efforts not only increased their pay, their health benefits, but also just set a precedent. This is an interesting position as well. They set a precedent for what is to be expected in Hollywood. Mm. So obviously we still have the SAG-AFTRA strike going on. And when you have a major win like this, what it does is it establishes the notion that workers can achieve more. And it sets that precedent in Hollywood, and hopefully that precedent expands to other fields as well.
Yeah, exactly. And with the momentum coming off of this strike, it also sets the precedent for a variety of other industries as well, not just Hollywood, because this was a huge strike. Hollywood is a huge industry. I mean, when you look at entertainment in the US, it's one of the biggest industries. And it's also one of the things we spend the most of our time on, too.
Yeah.
And especially the most of our leisure time when we're not busy at work. And so such a major piece of everyone's life, seeing that the workers that are a part of that are actually making real gains, I think is huge in terms of a cultural shift that we're starting to see, which is more supportive of workers, more supportive of strikes. You know, there was a time where people would slander strikes as people just being lazy and not wanting to go to work. But now people are understanding that this is one of the main tools that workers have to actually, you know, fight for their rights and fight for basic benefits from their employers.
Yeah, and something that's also super important to think about was the, especially because obviously the show, and if you're listening to this, our demographic show that, you know, it's with younger individuals, but older individuals were missing their talk shows. Like, I don't sit down and watch talk shows anymore, but talk shows were gone. Like, I didn't know this until like maybe 2-3 weeks ago before the strike was over. But like Jimmy Fallon wasn't on.
Yeah, yeah.
Jimmy Kimmel wasn't on.
And you know what they did too?
The other Jimmy, what?
They started a podcast.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course.
Like, they just weren't
unique getting, idea. Yeah. Never done before. But,
yeah, exactly. I don't know who would ever start a podcast.
But no, you had Seth Meyers is coming back. Last Week Tonight was gone. Last Week Tonight is always gone. John Oliver is one of those that I do mess, but you like John Oliver?
I mean, I'm not a huge fan of like late night shows in general.
I'm not a huge fan of late night shows.
But like when I see their clips, some of them are funny.
No, but John Oliver's good. He does do pretty good deep dives. We need to sit down and watch. We'll watch some John Oliver eventually.
To be fair, John Oliver is one of the better ones.
No, he is one of the better ones. I think he has good talking points as well. And he's the way that his show is done is pretty witty. And he's also just done good work outside of that too. I don't know. You know, I'm a big Community fan, and John Oliver was on Community. He was also the bird in the reenactment of the Lion King, the live reenactment. fire, always put it out fire. But no, they're back. Glad that they're back. And it was also nice to see these major figures in media stand in solidarity with the writers. And this was prior to the actor strike. A lot of these are members of, you know, SAG-AFTRA. A lot of these people that we're mentioning are members of SAG-AFTRA, but it was nice to see them even take solidarity with the writers before it was their turn to strike as well.
Yeah, exactly. Because obviously these are major celebrities and they would have had the resources to continue their shows without writers. And I saw Bill Maher shortly before the strike ended decided that he was going to bring his show back on with no writers and just him doing all this material. And you know, the fact that they still chose, whether it be to avoid controversy or out of the goodness of their own heart, they chose to stand in solidarity with the writers, which again is a really, really good thing.
Yeah, and this was an extremely long strike, which is another thing. And we talked about this as well. It was genuinely gross, and I don't know if we dived into it a lot the last episode, but it was genuinely gross to see what these executives were saying towards the people that make them their profit, quite literally make them their profits. They were saying that they were willing to hold out until, you know, these people foreclosed on their houses, and then so they were able to not eat. Like, these are literal human beings that you just don't want to pay them a little bit more money.
And the reality is, the only thing that would get them to actually pay them a little bit more money was the fact that they started tanking on their bottom line.
Yeah,
they didn't realize how valuable their actual work.
You know how much money Disney lost? Just Disney alone,
hundreds of millions.
In 2023, $300 to $500 million they lost from the strike.
Yeah.
Just because they don't want to pay them a little one.
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, they're so lame. They're so, so lame.
Like, they already have such ridiculous bottom lines.
Literally. No, because you saw, like, if you look at their pay increases, like, all of their pay increases for the past, like, decade have been going up by, like, 23%. Like, every year. Mm-hmm. But, like, what, they can't pay some dude that's trying to write a script and, like, make some money to feed his family while they're like, okay, we get it, you guys want to raise, but I'm trying to buy my eighth house and my third boat, so you guys need to get to writing scripts for free, please. But
I want my ninth Lamborghini.
Yeah, my ninth Lambo.
I want a purple wrap on it this house. Time, so like,
yeah,
you guys gotta,
yeah, exactly, you guys gotta cut it out. We're gonna get,
yeah, you guys gotta start for a couple months.
You've been replaced by ChatGPT. Actually,
I mean, but, and like that, yeah, that also in and of itself is insane. Because as time goes on, I mean, we're seeing it here, and we're also seeing it maybe even to an extent in the auto worker strike.
Yes, yeah.
Where technological advancements, largely in AI, are extremely influential in a lot of these strikes. Mm. Partly because workers are starting to realize that as more and more various labor is able to be automated,
yeah,
and I mean, also to an extent that we never even thought was possible with AI.
Yeah.
Like, whoever thought that writers could be replaced with robots anytime in our lifetime?
Yeah.
Until ChatGPT came out.
Yeah, literally.
People are starting to realize that they have no other choice but to unionize. Otherwise, employers are going to do the thing that makes them the most money, which is, guess what's a lot cheaper than having to pay for someone's labor, pay for their health care, pay for their benefits? Firing them and paying a computer science major, you know, $100 to write a script for you for an AI that can do all their jobs for you.
Exactly.
Which is a very scary prospect that we're starting to see.
No, yeah, it's I mean, it's absolutely terrifying, but I think that that's why we're also trying, or we're also starting to see the other side of it, where we're starting to see an increase in petitions to unionize. We're starting to see, you know, beyond the increase in petition, we're starting to see union activity go up. I had the statistic pulled up here, but it's gone up, I think, over 50%, just striking in and of itself has gone up over 50%, which is massive, right?
Yeah. People's viewpoints on union as well. Like,
yes.
Like popularity has gone way up.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that so many celebrities had their hands forced to support these unions and to not continue the work they were doing because of the backlash and the controversy they would have received.
Yeah, I mean, hell, the president of the United States
had
to literally go out and be the first sitting president to be in a picket line. Mm-hmm. To your point, we see the highest approval rating, and these are statistics that are a couple months old, but I'm sure that it's even higher now after all of this. But the highest approval rating in over half a century at 71%. These are literally union approval ratings that we haven't seen since the golden age of capitalism in the 1930s, where the highest it achieved was 72%. Mm-hmm. So these are major, major victories. But, you know, on the same point of how much money was lost by, you know, these Hollywood executives because of their desire to not pay people what they're entitled to be paid.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to mention the United Auto Workers.
Yeah.
That industry is projected to lose billions. With a B on it.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just insane because, like, the far smarter business option for them as well at this point is to cut their losses and give the workers the basic things that they're asking for.
Yeah.
Because at this point, the longer the strike goes on, the more and more it affects their bottom line, and the more and more it affects the fact that, like, they can't produce things without the laborers.
Yeah.
The laborers are essential to the corporation.
Yeah.
If you don't have the workers in a corporation, you can't make anything.
Yeah.
If you don't have the executive, you could just get another executive.
Yeah, the executive dies and you replace them. But what happens if every employee at Amazon dies? The whole company goes over.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Jeff Bezos disappears for 3 weeks and nothing happens. But
it already happens. He just goes to a random island that no one's ever heard of that he probably owns.
An interesting talking point. Did you get to catch up? Because, I mean, we're not going to do an episode on it, but I guess it is important to bring up. But the second Republican debate, the primary debate. Did you get to watch that? No, I didn't get a chance. Okay, so I got to watch some of the highlights. You want to know one of the very interesting talking points? Mm. So obviously, Republicans are never going to say that they're pro-union because they just won't. We discovered last time on the episode that Trump, when he was trying to go to the picket line, went to a auto store that sold non-unionized parts. Only non-unionized parts, which is really funny because, like, that's a very interesting niche to have in the auto industry. But
went
to non-unionized parts. But the talking point that they kept referring to was that the strikers were mad at the electric vehicle industry, that they were trying to blame EVs. They were saying that this transition to EVs is actually what's causing these workers to lose their money. And it's just like, I tried researching, like, okay, what's the because obviously this is coming from the Heritage Foundation or what's the other one? The American,
I don't know.
One of the think tanks.
Yeah, but, one of the think tanks that every Republican gets all their talking points from if you just Google it.
Yeah, no, literally, you can. It's so funny. When we used to do the show, did I ever tell you this? When we used to do the show a couple years ago, I would just go on the Heritage Foundation, and then I had a huge spreadsheet that just had every single Republican talking point, and I just memorized it. Because you can just memorize it. You can just memorize every single, especially like when you're doing a show like this.
Yeah.
They would just come on, and they say something, and you just go to the spreadsheet, Command F, and then just healthcare. Okay, cool. Yeah, this is your talking point on healthcare. Here's where that's like just not true. Because it's all the same statistics too. Like, did you ever hear the thing? Sorry, this is so off tangent, but did you ever hear the death panels? Like, you know how they criticize Canada for having
death tribunals? Yeah.
And then I was like, dude, what's the talking point behind these death tribunals? And it was like, essentially, their death tribunal is way better than what we do in the United States because it consists. So essentially, it's like when one of your family members or someone, you know, you care for is on life support and the decision to take them off is conflicted between the doctor and the family. So let's say the doctor wants to take them off, family doesn't. So they go to a panel of lawyers, doctors, citizens, and they present a case like immediately on whether this person is going to be taken off life support or not. And people were like, that's terrible. It should be a decision between a family and their doctor. You want to know what we do in the United States?
Mm.
You have to sue. The doctor has to sue, and you have to go through a 2-year lawsuit at least while this person's like
on life support.
Oh, is on life support.
And it's costing the family millions.
And it's costing the family millions. It's, you know, not benefiting the, there's this person's like organs are literally shutting down. They're having bed sores. Like they're in a lot of pain as well. But yeah, we just don't like death tribunals. As we refer to them.
Yeah,
but
we just throw a scary name on it and we're like, this is a bad thing.
Either way, I couldn't figure out what the EV talking point is. I don't know. I mean, I'll research it while we're talking, but yeah. They just kept saying that electric vehicles were the problem. Like there was nothing more to it. It wasn't like since electric vehicles became popular in this year or whatever, this and that has happened. It was just like, nah, electric vehicles. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, they're always going to play it as, I mean, this is a party that explicitly denied climate change, specifically to a young person. Like, they had this young person come on. I mean, everyone's going to remember this moment from the first debate, and I'm not sure if we talked about it before, but they had this young person come on and ask directly to the panel of like, hey, do you guys think climate change is like actually a thing? And overwhelmingly, they A, dodged the question, and B, the only one who answered it explicitly denied the fact. He was like, nah, it's fake, it's made up, it's not real, it's a Democrat hoax, it's propaganda. So like, at this, when you're looking at a party like that, who's going to deny those basic facts, of course they're going to blame the one like minor thing that we're trying to do to prevent like this oncoming essentially apocalypse that's going to only affect our generation, of course.
Yeah,
and they're going to blame it on those small solutions as opposed to the larger issue, which is the fact that like, what are they actually fighting for? Oh yeah, pay raises.
Yeah,
who's directly in control of that?
Yeah,
oh yeah, the employer.
Yeah, the employer.
So like, it's not a difficult leap at all.
No and on this point, I had a script written for his name's Alexander Diaz, the young man that got to ask the question from Catholic University. His name's Alexander Diaz, and he prefaces his question by mentioning that recent data shows that climate change is the number one issue for people of our generation, being a Gen Zer, and then asks, how will you, as both president of the United States and leader of the Republican Party, calm their fears that the Republican Party doesn't care about climate change? Then the moderator asks them to raise their hands if they believe in, quote, human behavior causing climate change, which was then followed by Ron DeSantis interrupting before any candidate had the opportunity. They like all like half-ass put their hand up, except for Vivek Ramaswamy, because of course he didn't. But
yeah,
Ron DeSantis is like, we're not kids, we don't need to put our hands up. And then Vivek's like, no, climate change isn't real. And it was just this really wholesome moment on the stage where like they could all breathe out and they're like, okay, we got to avoid this question. But
yeah, it was hilarious because Ron DeSantis saved everyone else's ass on that debate stage in that exact moment. Yeah. Ron DeSantis was just like interrupted, kept them all from like giving like a clear, honest answer or just like a yes or no by raising your hand.
Yeah.
Complete dodge. And then Vivek doesn't even take the slack that Ron DeSantis fought so hard to give him, and he's just like shit, like he just shits the bed.
It's absolutely ridiculous. Okay, I am finding some of the talking points
on EVs.
Yeah, so it's just that EVs require fewer parts and thus fewer workers to assemble vehicles, but like that's just part of the transition to it. So obviously, since you're going to have fewer workers and you're going to have fewer parts and whatnot and less work to be done, there's going to be less individuals working in the automotive industry. But the reality is that that's exactly why unions are needed, to make sure that you just don't get to a point where it's literally an AI fixing your car. Because that's the thing with the ECU inside of cars nowadays, you're essentially like a computer science kid and engineer when you're working on cars. Like it's so difficult.
Yeah,
I have an old car and a new car, and I don't touch my like my project car. Yeah, you can do anything that you want on it. You want to change a part, this, that, or the other. My new car, if you like change the brakes to something that it doesn't like, it's just like, yeah, no. Like this computer's like, you don't have brakes anymore.
Yeah,
and you can see them there, but the computer's like, no, you have to like rewire the whole system so that we can recognize these brakes.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's exactly why this union activity is needed.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, just on the EV point, I mean, I just looked it up really quickly. It's approximately less than 1% of cars in the US are electric.
Yeah.
And so they're going to blame it all on, like, you know, this reminds me of basically every issue that Republicans focus on, where they look at 1% of the population or 1% of a certain thing, and they pretend like it's a population that affects everybody everywhere and all the time.
Yeah.
When, like, that's just not the real issue.
Yes. Yeah. But going back to talking about the auto workers directly, an interesting thing that they're doing is the strategy that they're taking to engage in their union activity. I don't know if you've heard about this, but what the president has essentially made their strategy is that they're going on strikes at random times.
Mm.
So they're not at random times. Different factories. Let me get more specific.
Yeah.
Different factories at various locations across the country and now in Europe as well.
Mm.
This is becoming an international strike, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But it's becoming an international strike. And essentially the way that they're doing it is, like, they don't even know who's going to, like, they don't even know who's going to strike next. But just all of a sudden, you, like, expect all your employees to show up and they just don't. And it's putting the way that it's the idea behind it is that it's putting a bunch of pressure on these executives because they can't just, like,
they can't plan around it.
Yeah, they can't plan around it.
Because also, like, when you strike at a place for a significant amount of time, you know, at some point they try and work around it. They try and, you know, get employees who probably literally could not afford to strike because they would get evicted next week.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the strategy is that you're able to work around it. And that's really interesting, too, because they're using the element of surprise to essentially circumvent any ways in which the corporation could try and counter the fact that, oh, wait, all your workers aren't working anymore.
Yeah. And it's also, it's not something that I've necessarily heard done before.
No, I haven't heard about that previously.
But it is a very interesting strategy because, like you're saying, yeah, you can't plan around it because obviously, like, you know, what they were doing with, like, the WGA stuff is they just got every other, like broke person that's trying to be a writer in Hollywood to, like, be like, hey, you want to write a show? And then they figured out why they were broke and moved to LA. Couldn't write a show. But they did that, and that was, like, their, like, little band-aid on it for a while. And I mean, it just kind of messes up exactly what the executives are doing, but still, losses in the billions is going to be crazy.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I'm excited to see how all these strikes turn out, and I'm especially excited to see the future of union activity, especially with an increase of, you know, not just activity, but public support for unions. And, you know, I was mentioning earlier the fact that, like, people can't even come out publicly and say that they're against unions or that they're against the people striking because they'll just get so much hit with so much controversy, you know, they'll get canceled. And I'm excited to see, yeah, exactly, in air quotes for anyone who's just listening. And I'm just excited to see how this is going to affect union activity going forward. Because what I see, only positives. And I mean, coming off of a huge win from WGA, that's easy to say, but I'm excited for what's coming.
No. I think that it's undeniable momentum that is being created here. And I think that at this point, you know, I mentioned it possibly earlier. I think at this point in 10, 20, 30 years, when this is being written in history books, this will be the labor movement. Right. It's going to be, you know, you're going to look back at the labor movement of the 2020s and look at how that affected the position that we find ourselves in 20, 30 years from now. But
yeah, exactly. Also, just because there's no choice.
Mm.
If they don't strike, if they don't organize against these corporations, they're going to get replaced by literal robots.
Yeah, yeah.
And what happens also when you have no more consumers and no more workers,
yeah,
the companies who need people to pay them for whatever product they're producing fall apart.
Yeah.
And you also have no people working,
yeah,
who are all going to get evicted.
Yeah.
So people are seeing this massive crisis that's looming and a really dark storm that's coming in from the distance.
Yeah.
And luckily people are starting to fortify and unite against it.
Well, you know, like, I guess to transition back, because we did the victories from the WGA, went a little bit gloomy for a while. Let's talk about a corporation that did it right, or did it better. Let's go to that extent. UPS. So do you remember the Teamsters case happened about in August and whatnot? This is actually where a strike was averted, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was the potential for 300,000 members or Teamsters, as they're referred to go on strike. And UPS was just like, nah, we'll just pay y'all.
Yeah.
We're just like, it's just not worth you guys going on strike. So they had an increases in pay raise to $49 an hour, which is
wow,
absolutely amazing. They had healthcare benefits. increase, and 86% of the union supported. Like, think about that in terms of the politics that transcend inside of the United States. If something has 60% approval, we're like losing our mind over it. We're like, oh my God, why?
This is now, insane.
86% support is absurd. I mean, that's ridiculous.
That's amazing.
Think about something that has 86% support in the United States right now, and you can think of very, very, very few issues.
Yeah, and more than just UPS doing the right thing, they did the smart thing, because they averted what other corporations are seeing as hundreds of millions, and in the cases of the auto corporations, billions of dollars in losses. And, you know, they see that coming in the visor, and they said, no, thank you.
Yes.
They made the smarter play. Yes. And, you know, I hope corporations learn from the fact of all of these losses, and also seeing how UPS was able to avoid their massive losses, and start to realize that actually the smarter play is just paying your workers properly.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, corporations did not realize this, because now it's one of these bad and good things, is every time we're like, oh, workers are on strike, it sucks. It's difficult. It's not something that's the other part of this.
Mm.
It's something that it seemingly, and admittedly, we've celebrated on this episode, but we're also celebrating it from a position of privilege.
Yeah.
Striking is something extremely difficult. As you mentioned, these people face the potential to lose their jobs, and oftentimes they do, right?
Yeah.
What was it? 54%. The Economic Institute found that 54% of just union elections the corporations behind them engage in illegal activity to prevent these elections from happening, just the elections alone. So imagine in the strike activity, the various things that they do. They've been known to shut off AC inside of these places. They've been known to just affect them in various ways. So in the case of Las Vegas, it's another industry that is striking. 60,000 individuals are striking in the Las Vegas hospitality sector, and they didn't learn from the UPS Teamsters, and it's going to be, again, something difficult. But that's also why, or at least, you know, they've taken the vote to strike. They've authorized the strike. So now it's just a matter of when and how and whatnot. But that's why there's two things here. First and foremost, donate. A lot of these different organizations have what are referred to as relief funds. So in the case of strikes, in the case of walkouts, in the case of picketing, they can still eat, and their families can still eat, and they don't have to foreclose on their houses, and they don't have to not have health care. They're still afforded dignity and respect, as they should be, being working class Americans and working class people. And the second thing is express your solidarity. I think that there's a lot of jokes to be made about, people changing their profile pictures to a black square and whatnot during like solidarity for like the Black Lives Matter movement and how effective it is. But this is something that I think is a little bit different when you, and I don't know if you agree with this, Max, when you express your solidarity towards a strike that's happening.
Yeah, definitely. Because you're countering a lot of corporate propaganda, essentially, where they're trying to distribute material throughout, you know, every cultural sphere to try and degrade the union strikers and to try and essentially slander these people who are just trying to fight for, you know, basic rights and basic things they need to live. And so I think any form of solidarity that you can show and support is one small piece in countering the cultural shift that corporations are trying to fight against. And they're trying to fight against it because, you know, they want to cut down on their costs, and they're only really care about profit at the end of the day.
Yep. Yep.
And so I do definitely think that solidarity is important, especially considering, you know, I believe it's over 70% of workers in this country live paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
Meaning that if you go on strike for a couple months, think about the amount of bills that you can't pay.
Yeah.
You know, if you miss...
You go on strike for 2 weeks. If you go on strike
for
2 weeks, you're falling behind on every single bill that you have to pay and every debt and everything that you have.
Exactly. Which is why these, you know, union funds are so important.
Yeah.
Because they're the only way that strikes can keep going. Because at a certain point, you know, the corporations can win. Just like those corporate executives said. They're just going to wait for them to essentially starve themselves until the corporations win.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of the day, any amount helps. And any show of solidarity for these people helps as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also the IWW. Please head over to the IWW.org. But with that being said, we at Politatine and the Ox Institute want to end off by saying that we do stand in solidarity with all of these union activities. You know, last episode we had a list, but at this point the list is becoming so expansive, and I do really want it to stand the test of time. But we have the UAW that's striking right now. We have SAG-AFTRA. We have the Las Vegas hospitality workers. Obviously, the economic hardship that was presented to those that were engaged in the WGA strikes. It's going to take time to recover as well. That's another thing that's also forgotten. The strike is over, but the debts that these people have to catch up on, the mortgage payments that these people have to catch up on, even simple things like health checkups that maybe they missed out on. Cancer screenings that they weren't afforded the opportunity to receive. So that's why it's again, it's important, and we want both at Politatine and the Ox Institute to say that we stand in solidarity. And again, as we said last time, remember that united we bargain, divided we beg. Max, thank you so much for joining me for part two of this amazing special. It was a pleasure and an absolute honor to just get to talk about such an important issue.
Yeah, exactly. And thank you for having me on.
Yes, absolutely. And to all of you listening, if you want to stay connected with everything that the Ox Institute and Politatine is doing, be sure to head over to oxinstitute.org. And once again, thank you for tuning in to yet another episode of the Politatine Podcast. Goodbye.
Bye.